more pipelines. The movement is getting bigger, it's converging. In 2016, we're hoping to see a huge amount because people are taking back power.
From Arc de Triomphe to the Eiffel Tower, voices from around the world in the streets of Paris on December 12th, Saturday, the day the Paris Agreement was approved. That does it for Climate Countdown. Special thanks to John Hamilton, Dennis Moynihan, and Chuck Skirich, as well as the Associated Press team in Paris, Phil Hastie, Dave Pentlow, Colin McKay, Sean Russell, Brent Stanton, Vidal Cohen, Yohai Morimoto, Kiri Lumsden, James Lewis, Toby Good, Joseph Dillon, and Democracy Now!'s Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Renee Feltz, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Ravi Karan, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Ornette, Made in America, showing Thursday, December 17th at 7 p.m. Released in 1985, Ornette, Made in America, explores the rhythms, images, and myths of America seen through the eyes of an Ornette Coleman's imagination and artistic evolution over three decades. Again, that's Ornette, Made in America, Thursday, December 17th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Music, Nature, and Storytelling, an experiential weekend workshop from January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center in Vernonia, Oregon. Storytelling as a practice broadens our perspective and helps us understand the significance of our experiences. This workshop teaches the roots of storytelling and delves into the storyteller's mind. No prior experience required, and the deadline for registration is December 18th. Again, that's Music, Nature, and Storytelling, a weekend workshop January 8th through the 10th at Cedar Ridge Retreat in Vernonia, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the COP21 Global Climate Change talks in Paris ended on Sunday with the signing of a non-binding agreement that countries wean themselves off fossil fuels over the next several decades.
The jury has begun deliberations in the first trial for the murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore.
And a former Washington County Sheriff's deputy was arrested and charged with several crimes on Sunday.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 14th, 2015. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. On Sunday, both directions of Highway 30 and the St. John's Bridge were closed for several hours after a fuel tanker truck crashed and caught fire. The semi-truck hauling a tanker load of fuel went over an embankment just east of the St. John's Bridge, killing the driver. The tanker truck came to rest next to several rail cars sitting on the tracks just below the road. Flames from the fire burned several of the rail cars. The fire sent a large cloud of smoke into the air that could be seen for miles. Nearby residents in St. John's were warned to close their windows and shelter in a place, as authorities initially did not know what was burning in the fire and if the asphalt in the rail cars had caught fire. It was later determined that none of the asphalt in the railroad cars had burned. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Don Steiny with the Vancouver branch of the Sierra Club.
A derailment spill followed by fire and explosion is pretty much guaranteed to happen somewhere between the Bakken oil fields and the delivery spot in Klatskanai. And it could be in Portland, it could be in Vancouver or Camas or Washougal or Spokane. And it's just a matter of luck whether or not you avoid a catastrophe.
And right now, under consideration in Vancouver is the proposal for the largest rail-by-oil terminal in the country. Could you talk a little bit about that and the potential risks?
Yes, oil by rail. This is the largest oil by rail facility proposed in America. It's being proposed in Vancouver, just downstream from the I-5 bridge, about 2 or 3 miles. And it would have 4 unit trains of crude oil per day. And each train is about 1.25 miles long, so roughly 5 miles per day of loaded oil trains. And the people doing the environmental impact studies they don't seem to be doing a very good job, in my opinion. They said there'd be only one tank car lose its cargo in 27 years. Well, there's been 15 tank derailment spills in the last 2.5 years, and about 13 of them have caught fire, and about 11 of them have exploded. And for them to say there'd be only one in 27 years, are they kidding? Originally, it was called the DeSarro-Savage Joint Venture, and now they've renamed it as Vancouver Energy. This is huge. This is the largest oil terminal proposed in America. And this is the last thing we should be doing right after the Paris climate talks. There's no way that we're going to be able to avoid catastrophic climate change if we build new fossil fuel infrastructure. So we need to prevent new stuff coming online.
Again, I'm speaking with Don Steinke. He is a Vancouver, Washington resident, a Sierra Club volunteer. He has joined us today to speak about the truck collision with oil train cars that took place yesterday, Sunday, December 13th, in Portland, and the potential for more volatile explosions and accidents if a oil terminal moves forward as planned in Vancouver, Washington. There's public comment on that terminal, two of them taking place in Clark County, Tuesday, January 5th and Tuesday, January 12th. More information on those can be found on the Columbia Riverkeeper website, columbiariverkeeper.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A local rally and march in response to the Paris climate talks took place on Saturday with around 500 people participating. Activists in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia all held protests saying they're drawing their own green line of resistance against new large-scale fossil fuel developments. I spoke with Mia Reback of 350 PDX about Saturday's action for climate justice.
There was a march for climate justice in Portland last Saturday. What was the purpose of the march?
On Saturday, the closing Saturday of the Paris climate talks, there was a call to action for grassroots communities around the world to come together for rallies, marches, protests of all kinds to really show that there is a strong grassroots commitment to climate justice and to bringing about immediate climate action, regardless of what that final outcome from the Paris climate talks ended up being.
And Saturday was a very wet day in Portland. I don't need to remind our listeners about that. Not the best conditions for a march. How many people were there to participate?
Over 500 people showed up to participate, which is really amazing given the weather. And I think it's especially notable that we were having these three uncharacteristic storms in Portland, flooding that isn't characteristic. And these are starting to feel the impacts of climate change here in Portland. So it was especially powerful that so many people came out in spite of the rain, in spite of the wind and flooding, to really come together to, you know, really make that call to action for climate justice.
Oh, that's an interesting point. What was that point made at the march, the connection between the extreme weather we've been having and climate change?
It was, and actually one of the speakers for the rally wasn't able to make it because of road closures.
Irony, huh? Oh, Mia, could you describe what went on at the march? It started with a rally, right? And there was some music and some speakers?
Yeah, it got kicked off in the morning with Love Bomb Go-Go, an amazing local marching band, performing to get really high spirits, followed by a bunch of representing different aspects of the climate justice movement here in the Portland area. And then after the speakers, the 500 people marched across the Tillicum Crossing, the Bridge of the People, in this really beautiful call for climate justice. And it was especially amazing, you know, being there at the Tillicum Crossing, this bridge built not to allow private cars, and it's really the bridge of the future and the type of infrastructure and planning that we really need to see across the board and really planning for the type of world we want to live in.
You mentioned, of course, that Saturday was a big day. World leaders in Paris signed that worldwide climate accord. There was a march in Paris that day. I read with over 10,000 participants, and of course, marches and rallies both in the Pacific Northwest and across the globe. Was there planning by your organization and other organizations to coordinate these events?
Yes. So these events were all coordinated following a call to action that was put out by many organizations, including 350.org. And we at 350PDX are the local chapter. So it was coordinated. And it's this really powerful model in the climate movement right now of these decentralized call to actions where together, when we act all around the world, we amplify and echo each other's voices. But it really speaks power to the fact that solutions are coming from the ground up. Communities are more tuned into their needs, what kind of solutions they need. And it's really comes to these global agreements to really make sure that the equity and justice pieces are in place across the world. And unfortunately, the agreement signed on Saturday is really missing some of the human rights components, gender, equity, justice elements were really missing from that call. But communities around the world are picking up where governments are leaving off.
And you mentioned these communities. I would imagine some of them are focusing on specific issues that are more particular to those communities. I wonder, are activists in the Pacific Northwest, are there any particular issues that you're focusing on to help alleviate climate change?
The Pacific Northwest has become a proposed corridor to transport massive volumes of fossil fuels to new markets, solidifying the growth and expansion of the fossil fuel industry for decades to come, which is exactly the type of thing that we need to stop in order to really address climate change from getting worse than it already is. So here in Portland in the Northwest, there are these some 27 proposed projects, many of whom are coming up. So the Tesoro Savage oil terminal in Vancouver, Washington is going to be, if it's built, the largest oil by rail terminal in the entire country. Its volume of crude is about one-third that of the Keystone XL pipeline. And that has a big hearing coming up on January 5th in Vancouver, Washington. And that's one of these climate red lines, a project that we cannot afford to build in order to keep climate from crossing over into catastrophic tipping points. And so it's really important that people in Portland and in the Northwest get involved in stopping these projects so we can go about bringing about what we do want, like clean, renewable energy, energy democracy, and a just economy for everyone.
And Mia, one last question. Where can KBOO listeners go to find out more about how to support these actions and alleviate climate change?
KBOO listeners can go to 350pdx.org, that's our website, to stay up to date on events and actions and campaigns happening in Portland and across the Pacific Northwest to address climate change.
We've been talking with Mia Reback, an organizer with 350PDX. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
The COP21 Global Climate Change talks ended on Sunday in Paris with the signing of a non-binding agreement that countries wean themselves off of fossil fuels over the next several decades. The agreement calls for no more than 2 degrees of global warming over the next several decades, but provides no mechanisms to enforce actual reductions in the release of greenhouse gases. Climate activists immediately protested the deal for lacking enforcement mechanisms and for leaving it up to each individual country on how to decrease greenhouse gas emissions. It has been reported that the United States and Canada fought the hardest to preclude any actual binding agreements. In several instances, the two countries required that binding terminology using the word shall was changed to the word should, making the clause unenforceable. James Hansen, the former NASA scientist and world-renowned climate change activist, called the agreement worthless, saying, quote, "It's a fraud, really, a fake. It's just worthless words. There's no action, only promises." To learn more about the Paris talks, KBOO reporter Chris Andre spoke with Chris Williams, a longtime environmental activist and professor at Pace University.
What they tried to do in order, or have successfully managed to do as far as the mainstream media is concerned, is to camouflage the ongoing catastrophic changes to the biosphere that we're bringing about by moving from a 2 degrees C target to a 1.5 degrees C target, which on the one hand, you know, then you can say, well, we're much more serious now because we've got a lower target, which the science tells us we cannot go above that. Otherwise, things get very scary, especially for the people who are least responsible for creating this problem in the first place. But having set that target, which then gets all the headlines, all of the details about how that might be achieved in practice are completely lost because none of the countries who've signed on, of the 190-odd countries, none of that is going to add up to even 2 degrees because it's all headed towards 3 Celsius, which we know would be absolutely cataclysmic and an existential threat, really, to large chunks of humanity, different cultures around the world, and large numbers of species, not to mention what's going on with the oceans and so on and so forth. So I think they've managed to cover up all of the inadequacies by having this harder, better target, and yet there's no mechanism for achieving it. We all ultimately depend on growing food and agriculture, and that's what society is predicated on for the last 10,000 years, or the majority of the planet anyway. And so if we can't predict the seasons and when it's going to rain by how much and where, then that kind of jeopardizes the whole of human civilization. So I think if you talk to anybody who subsists on the land, then farmers, then they already will tell you, and fishermen, fisher people too, that things are changing. Insects, plants are moving their range. Fish are moving where they exist, either to colder waters. And so the changes are already going on, and people who are intimately connected with the land or the oceans or the rivers already see them. As to larger questions of when do we get more people involved, I mean, I think on the one hand, the very point that they've made at 1.5 Celsius of warming instead of 2 is actually in large part down to not just the science telling us that that's what needs to happen, but actually the pressure from grassroots organizations and people on the ground, you know, the giant climate march last year, 400,000 people in New York City. I mean, these things had an impact on consciousness and even on the politicians. The question is, how do we redouble our efforts and spread them and then make them, the politicians, instead of ignoring us and cozying up to the corporations, how can we reverse that dynamic or get rid of the politicians altogether? And in terms of voting them out of office and bringing in a whole new way of organizing society, which is something that I would advocate for. So how do you get more people involved when maybe it's not an immediate concern? I think there are immediate concerns. I mean, look at transportation, for example. That's got a whole connection to climate. Look at health and the quality of the air that we breathe. Look at the food situation. I think people are very upset and angry about the continued industrialization and impoverishment of our food supply system and the environmental damage that that's doing. So I think there are a number of entry points for getting more people involved and also connecting it to where we have some power, which is as workers. I think, how do we... There are unions now, including in the United States, that want to see a transition to clean energy and more public transport, all of those kind of excellent projects, so which would employ tens of millions of people. So I think it's connecting all these things together and redoubling our efforts, really, because it's very clear now that faced with a choice of saving capitalism or saving the planet, global leaders will choose to save capitalism.
That was KBOO's Chris Andre speaking with environmental activist and author Chris Williams about the new global climate change agreement.
Oregon legislators are mulling over options for an electric vehicle rebate in 2017. In the legislative session this past spring, lawmakers voted down a rebate program that would have given $3,000 to electric car owners and $1,500 to hybrid owners. At the time, they said the rebates were not feasible, given the state's tight budget. At a leadership summit this morning at the Oregon Convention Center, the head of Drive Oregon, an electric vehicle trade association, said that every electric vehicle purchased in Oregon returns up to $1,500 in economic activity to the state. He pushed for the state legislature to adopt rebates for electric vehicles in the 2016 session. But even if budget pressures keep that from happening, the State Building Codes Division will be adopting a new electric vehicle charging station pilot program in 2017. All new parking lots built in the state of Oregon with 50 spaces or more will be required to have an electric vehicle charging station.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Israel, Turkey, and oil being smuggled by Daesh. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. Then it's Prison Pipeline at 6:30. Emma Lugo interviews Mindy Griffith and Kristen Floor from the program Voices of the Cannabis War for an in-depth discussion of jury nullification. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: isolated showers before 7 p.m., patchy fog after 10 p.m., otherwise mostly cloudy with a low around 35. Tomorrow, a 20% chance of rain after 10 a.m., patchy fog before 10 a.m., otherwise mostly cloudy with a high near 42. Today in history: in 1985, Wilma Mankiller was inaugurated as the first woman principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, and in 2008, Iraqi journalist Montazar al-Zaidi threw his shoes at then-President George W. Bush during a news conference, for which he served 9 months in prison in Iraq. The quote of the day is from Wilma Mankiller, who said, "The happiest people I've ever met, regardless of their profession, their social standing, or their economic status, are people that are fully engaged in the world around them. The most fulfilled people are the ones who get up every morning and stand for something larger than themselves. They are the people who care about others, who will extend a helping hand to someone in need, or will speak up about an injustice when they see it."
It's 5:23. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Don Blankenship did not get what he deserves in his federal trial, but he definitely deserves what he got. Guilty, declared all 12 West Virginia jurors who pondered the charge that this arrogant and avaricious CEO of Massey Energy, Inc. willfully conspired to violate America's mine safety laws. As a result of that conspiracy, 29 miners were essentially murdered by the corporation on April 5, 2010, in a horrific explosion deep inside Massey's Upper Big Branch coal mine. Blankenship, a multimillionaire right-wing ideologue, union buster, and political heavyweight, ran the UBB mine like a lawless third-world operator. It was one of the most dangerous workplaces in the country, because this kingpin of King Coal relentlessly put profit over people, recklessly endangering miners. But coal is, indeed, king in West Virginia, so the laws are written to coddle the royals of the industry. Thus, Blankenship's guilt is to be punished by a maximum of 1 year in prison, and his diamond-studded legal team intends to have the jury's unanimous verdict of guilt tossed down the dark shaft of judicial favoritism for the rich. What the mining baron deserved was to be put in stocks on the state's capitol grounds, where he would be subjected to a steady stream of derision from the families of mine workers who were degraded, made ill, and even killed to haul up coal so Don could live in luxury. He escaped that justice, but he'll never shake off the guilty judgment of the jurors or of the American people who followed the month-long, widely covered trial that fully documented the rank immorality of this man and his ill-gotten fortune. This is Jim Hightower saying he undoubtedly thinks he got away with murder, but in the court of public opinion, his legacy is that he has turned the name Blankenship into a four-letter word.
The Portland State University Board of Trustees voted unanimously to begin the process to place a ballot initiative on the 2016 general election ballot. If passed, the college affordability proposal initiative is expected to raise between $30 and $70 million per year by imposing a payroll tax of 0.1% on businesses within the metro boundaries. The money would be used to fund scholarships for local students and to hire new faculty and staff at the university. If a second reading of the initiative is approved by the PSU Board of Trustees in January, the initiative process of collecting signatures would begin.
Tomorrow, December 15th, marks the deadline for open enrollment in a health insurance plan. Healthcare for All Oregon held a rally today. In opposition to the rate hikes and high deductibles that insurance companies have put in place in response to the Affordable Care Act. According to Healthcare for All Oregon, Moda Health put their name on the Rose Garden for about $40 million. Now it's claiming to be in deep financial trouble and raising its premiums 25% while cutting access to over 700 Providence doctors in 2016. Taxpayers are also footing some of the bill for a largely unsecured loan that Moda recently received from OHSU. A report last month by the Alliance for Health Equity found that 383,000 Oregonians still lack health coverage. Healthcare for All Oregon rallied today in advance of the December 15th deadline for enrollment, saying that the Affordable Care Act has failed to provide real access to care for both the hundreds of thousands of Oregonians without insurance and the tens of thousands of Oregonians who still cannot access care despite having insurance, as they cannot afford the copays and deductibles.
A new report from the Federal Centers for Disease Control reveals that the number of drug overdose deaths in the U.S. continues to climb. More than 47,000 people in the U.S. died of a drug overdose in 2014, up from almost 44,000 the year before. That includes both legal and illegal drugs. Nearly 19,000 overdose deaths involve prescription opiate painkillers, alone or in combination with other drugs, including alcohol. Deaths attributed to heroin topped 10,000 this year for the first time ever. The Obama administration's 2010 National Drug Control Policy Strategy Report set a goal of a 15% drop in overdose deaths by 2015. The CDC reports that in 2010, there are more than just over 38,000 total overdose deaths, about 16,600 overdose deaths attributed to opiate painkillers, and just over 3,000 overdose deaths attributed to heroin.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers International Executive Board is urging rejection of the TPP trade deal. A formal resolution against the TPP said that the USW sought a trade agreement for the U.S. and Canada that would lift wages up rather than pushing them down, one that would reduce our nation's accumulated trade deficits that continue to mount, one that would promote domestic manufacturing and employment rather than more outsourcing and offshoring, one that would begin to reverse the widening gap of income inequality. Steelworkers President Leo Girard, UAW President Dennis Williams, and Teamsters President Jim Hoffa co-wrote an opinion piece that concluded, quote, despite the efforts of supporters to frame this 12-nation Pacific Rim agreement as the gold standard and one that would stick up for the interests of millions of workers in the U.S. and abroad, the TPP fails on all counts.
Senator Bernie Sanders is being virtually blacked out on corporate network news despite poll numbers showing he would fare better than Hillary Clinton against the GOP field of presidential contenders. This is despite Sanders drawing the biggest crowds and having poll numbers that equal Donald Trump's. The Tyndall Report, which tracks CBS, NBC, and ABC network news coverage, says that so far this year, ABC has devoted 81 minutes to Trump and a mere 20 seconds to Sanders. NBC gave Sanders 2.9 minutes, CBS 6.4 minutes through the end of November.
This is Mitch Lawrence with a Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. The National Football League is dealing these days with an alarming life and death issue, namely concussions. A lot of people think that the NFL has turned its back on many of its former players who have ended up after their careers with severe brain injuries, some of whom even took their own lives because they spent too much time using their heads as projectiles. There have been lawsuits against the NFL by scores of former players, and on Christmas Day, there will be the release of a new movie called Concussion, about how the league tried to cover up the extent of brain trauma injury. Clearly, this is no laughing matter, even if Roger Staubach tried to turn it into one the other night. During a black tie dinner in New York, the former star of the Dallas Cowboys made a joke mocking his own history of concussion. By his own count, Staubach suffered at least 10 concussions back in the 60s and 70s as he was quarterbacking Dallas's two Super Bowl wins. Now he's the one making jokes, rather than being a spokesman for the players to address this serious issue. Staubach still has a lot of clout in football circles. He was called Captain America during his playing days because he was clean-cut and had played college football at the Navy Academy. Now he's doing a disservice to everyone and anyone who has ever paid a high price for playing pro football. It's no laughing matter, and Roger Staubach is the last one who needs to be reminded of that.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A former Washington County deputy is in jail today on charges of coercion, misconduct, domestic assault, and domestic strangulation. Jonathan Christensen faces charges for an incident this past March in which he forced himself into a colleague's home while he was on duty. He then choked her and forced her to have sex with him. The two had previously had a romantic relationship, but the woman had broken it off with Christensen sometime before. The sheriff's office had received an anonymous tip about misconduct by Christensen and others back in April, but only put him on paid leave and did not take disciplinary action against him. It was only in August that Christensen was fired from his job. Now, more than 8 months after the assault, Christensen is finally in jail pending a trial.
Jury selection began today in the first of several cases against six police officers in Baltimore for the wrongful death of Freddie Gray. The 25-year-old black man was taken into custody for allegedly possessing a knife. While en route to the jail, he was given what officers call a rough ride, in which he was handcuffed in the back of a police van that was then driven abruptly and aggressively, causing multiple injuries that led to his death. William Porter is the first of six Baltimore police officers to go on trial in Gray's death. He's being charged with reckless endangerment, assault, misconduct, and involuntary manslaughter. The officer faces a maximum of 25 years in prison. In order to find Porter guilty of involuntary manslaughter, prosecutors need to prove that he acted in a grossly negligent manner, creating a high degree of risk to human life. Prosecutors assert that criminal negligence happened when Gray was transported without a seatbelt, which is standard policy in Baltimore. Prosecutor Janice Bledsoe told the court that for Freddie Gray, the police van became, quote, a casket on wheels. Defense attorneys said that Gray's death was a horrible tragedy, but they claim that there was no evidence that Porter's actions caused the death. Prosecutors consider Officer Porter a material witness, and his testimony will be used against the other officers in their coming trials.
A California man was shot and killed on Saturday by a hail of more than 30 bullets fired by sheriff's deputies. Surveillance video of the incident shows 28-year-old Nicholas Robertson holding an object in his hand, which police claim is a gun. It's unclear from the surveillance footage what the object is. And at no point in the videos does Robertson ever raise the object. It is in his hand, by his side, the whole time. After allegedly failing to follow police orders, several officers opened fire. The shots continue as Robertson tries to walk away. And then when he's on the ground, and trying to crawl away, he is shot again. More than 30 bullets were fired at the 28-year-old black man, resulting in his death. People gathered on Monday at the site of the killing, on Skid Row in Los Angeles. Robertson was known to his friends and family as Africa.
Seven cadets at the Citadel Academy, who appeared in photos with pillowcases over their heads similar to Ku Klux Klan robes, have been suspended. Officials at the State Military College in Charleston, South Carolina, say they did not approve the action and have sent the cadets home. Meanwhile, local activists have called for the resignation of the college's president. The photos made the rounds of social media sites last week, showing seven freshman cadets wearing white t-shirts and white pants with pillowcases on their heads that resembled Klan hoods. At a protest across from the gates to the military college, activists say that the state should stop funding the school and the president should resign. The college is located in the same town where a white supremacist gunned down nine congregants in a church last summer. After the shooting at the Emmanuel Ames Church in June, the Citadel Academy's Board of Visitors agreed to remove the Confederate Naval Jack from a chapel on campus. But the flag has not yet been removed, as it requires approval from the South Carolina General Assembly under the state's Heritage Act.
The latest addition to the fleet of U.S. combat vessels had to be towed into port while on its very first mission, just 3 weeks after it was commissioned. The USS Milwaukee reported a complete loss of propulsion on Friday. The military called the incident an engineering casualty caused by fine metal fibers that collected in the lube oil filter system. The Milwaukee is one of 20 ships built under a contract with Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics, who subcontracted with shipbuilders in Wisconsin and Alabama. According to the Project on Government Oversight, this is not the first time Lockheed Martin has mishandled government contracts. The company currently faced penalties totaling nearly $8.4 million for five separate instances of misconduct. The infractions include two charges of overbilling and a charge of using federal funds for lobbying. That drew a penalty of more than $4 million.
Radiation levels have spiked by 4,000% in tunnels below the reactor buildings at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. New water samples showed a 4,000% increase in both alpha and beta ray emitting radioactive isotopes, including cesium, strontium, tritium, xenon, and plutonium. Authorities do not know why radiation levels have spiked and are still unable to enter the buildings due to the extremely high radiation levels. In other Fukushima news, in an attempt to stop the more than 400 tons of radioactive groundwater that flows daily through the basement containment areas before entering the nearby Pacific Ocean, Fukushima authorities built a wall almost 800 meters long and 100 feet deep. The wall was completed in October of this year, but large vertical cracks running along 70% of the wall's length have already developed. The wall is now leaning up to 20 centimeters towards the ocean. In yet more Fukushima news, a Japanese ministry committee has announced plans to form an expert panel to study the feasibility of burying high-level radioactive waste under the seabed in waters up to 20 kilometers off the coast of Japan. The panel will meet initially in January to discuss the technical challenges that would occur by burying radioactive nuclear waste under the Pacific Ocean seabed.
The far-right wing National Front was foiled in the second round of voting in French regional elections held on Sunday. The results were attributed to tactical voting and a larger-than-expected turnout, prompted in part by warnings from the left against the resurgence of xenophobia and anti-Semitism. The Socialist Party of current French President François Hollande took five of France's 13 regions with about 38% of the popular vote. The Republican Party of former President Nicolas Sarkozy took seven regions, also gaining about 38% of the popular vote. The Corsican Nationalist Party, for Corsica, won control of its region for the first time, taking more than 35% of the popular vote there. France's presidential election is 18 months from now.
A French preschool teacher who said he was attacked this morning by a man shouting support for ISIS admitted that he made the story up. The 45-year-old teacher, whose name has not been released, claimed that a masked man stabbed him in the throat and abdomen while shouting that the attack was for Daesh. Daesh is another name for ISIS or the Islamic State. After being taken to a hospital for non-life-threatening injuries, the teacher admitted that he fabricated the story. French prosecutors said the teacher wounded himself with a box cutter and was now being questioned as to why he lied. The incident led to a manhunt in the northern Paris suburb of Aubervilliers, and all classes at the preschool where the man teaches were canceled. The Paris prosecutor's office also opened an investigation for attempted murder in relation to a terrorist act. France remains on high alert following the terror attacks in Paris on November 13th that claimed the lives of 130 people.
Saudi Arabians voted 20 women into public office on December 12th, which was the country's first election to allow female voters and candidates. More than 900 women ran for seats. They competed with about 6,000 men for spots on 284 councils. While it was a landmark election, Saudi women still face multiple roadblocks in their quest to be more politically involved. Female contenders were not allowed to meet face-to-face with male voters during the campaign process. Women were only allowed to take spots on local councils dealing with issues like public streets and trash collection. Female involvement in national lawmaking is still prohibited.
The city of Homs is now back under the control of Syrian government forces. After a ceasefire last week with rebel groups, the Nusra Front and Daesh fighters took buses out of town to the northwest of Syria. And this weekend, cheering crowds lined the streets as Syrian government forces moved in and began clearing away the rubble of months of fighting. Some members of Syria's Christian minority even began stringing Christmas lights in the old city of Homs, expressing hope that the ceasefire will hold. Elsewhere, U.S. forces dropped more bombs in Iraq and Syria over the weekend. Although the U.S. is apparently fighting the same enemy that the Syrian government is fighting, U.S. officials refuse to cooperate with the Syrian government in the fight against Daesh or ISIS. President Obama gave a briefing this morning on the latest bombing.
We are hitting ISIL harder than ever. Coalition aircraft, our fighters, bombers, and drones have been increasing the pace of airstrikes, nearly 9,000 as of today. Last month, in November, we dropped more bombs on ISIL targets than any other month since this campaign started. We're also taking out ISIL leaders, commanders, and killers, one by one. Since this spring, we've removed Abu Sayyaf, one of their top leaders, Haji Mutaz, ISIL's second-in-command, Junaid Hussein, a top online recruiter, Muhammad Emwazi, who brutally murdered Americans and others, and in recent weeks, finance chief Abu Saleh, senior extortionist Abu Mariam, and weapons trafficker Abu Rahman al-Tunisi. The list goes on. We're going after ISIL from their stronghold right in downtown Raqqa to Libya, where we took out Abu Nabil, the ISIL leader there. The point is, ISIL leaders cannot hide, and our next message to them is simple: you are next.
The extrajudicial assassinations that President Obama referred to in his statement also resulted in the deaths of numerous civilians. The U.S. government has tried to pressure Iraqi officials to allow U.S. forces to bomb the town of Ramadi, which is currently controlled by Daesh. So far, the Iraqi government has resisted U.S. pressure to engage in airstrikes on the city, where many civilians remain in their homes and in shelters.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, December 14th, 2015. Israeli police kill a Palestinian youth in Jerusalem and jet fighters bombard areas in the Gaza Strip. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian youth was shot and killed on Monday evening by Israeli police near the central bus station in West Jerusalem. According to Israeli police, Abid Hassouna, 21, was shot dead by police officers after he rammed his car into a group of settlers. 10 settlers were injured, including 7 who sustained moderate to critical wounds, the Israeli police stated. Up until the time of this report, it's not clear whether the incident is a traffic accident or not. Abid is from the town of Beit Hanina in Jerusalem. In other news, Israeli settlers kidnapped on Monday afternoon three Palestinian youth from the village of Ya'bud near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Palestinian sources said that a group of armed settlers from the illegal Israeli settlement of Mabo Dotan, built on Palestinian lands, kidnapped three youth as they were farming their lands. The settlers released the three youth hours later after assaulting them, local sources reported. On Monday at dawn, nine Palestinians have been kidnapped after dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded various Palestinian communities in different parts of the southern West Bank district of Hebron. One Palestinian was kidnapped in Jerusalem during dawn invasion and home searches in the city. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers carried out on Monday at dawn excessive military searches of Palestinian homes in Karyut village in the northern West Bank district of Nablus and kidnapped eight Palestinians. In the Gaza Strip, the Israeli Air Force carried out on Monday at dawn two airstrikes targeting a training camp for the Al-Qassam Brigades, the arming of Hamas, and the Palestinian Naval Police in the besieged and impoverished Gaza Strip. The attacks caused excessive damage, but no casualties were reported. On Sunday evening, the Israeli radio said that a shell allegedly fired from Gaza detonated in an open area in the Sha'ar Negev Regional Council of Settlements, causing no damage or casualties. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 14th, 2015 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi, Hammi, Ghassan Badnoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Steve Oster, Joanna Peterson, Robin Ryan, Ken Jones, and Chris Andre. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast.